particles orbiting each other. They lose energy and angular momentum to gravitational radiation in spiral, merge, ring down, and you're left with another black hole at the end. Trying to understand this and trying to simulate this has been the holy grail of numerical relativity for some time now. People have been working on this problem for decades, but it's very computationally intensive. Einstein's equations are highly nonlinear. If you don't choose the right gauge, or your equations are in a form that isn't suitable, non-physicality will grow quickly. People had trouble even doing a single orbit in full numerical relativity.
But finally, a breakthrough came, courtesy of many, including Franz Mercurius, who are shown here. And in 2005, they simulated the very first binary black hole merger. And this was with non-spinning black holes. And it was not until earlier this year, 2007, that spinning black holes were merged as well. And that's interesting because we think a lot of astrophysical black holes can be spinning. So this is a conference about near-term observations. Dan covered a lot of this ground. LIGO is very near-term. It just finished up its fifth science run, which achieved design sensitivity. LISA hopefully will fly in 2020. I want to be optimistic. And this is also going to be looking at binary black hole mergers in galaxies as opposed to stellar mass ones. And then to some extent, black holes have a lot of feedback in the universe through AGN, through the effect, the dynamical effect of the centers of galaxies. So the fruits of black hole mergers are going to be seen in astrophysics as well. So we've simulated these things. We're going to be observing them shortly. And we wanted to take a fresh look and see if we could say something from the analytical side. Our approach is, from Kerr to Kerr, you can go home again. So we said, now, relativists can simulate now an entire merger. You start off with a large separation of two Kerr black holes. They in-spiral. There's a very, when they get, very close to each other, a few Schwarzschild radius, they'll merge, they'll form a common event horizon. And this is a very complicated process that can be only simulated in numerical relativity. Then finally, it can ring down. You can treat that ring down in black hole perturbation theory, and you're left again with a Kerr black hole. So this process is very complicated and has been very challenging, and which is why it's been so hard to simulate. But the initial and final state, the initial state of two widely separated Kerr black holes, is much simpler, and the final state of a final black hole is also simple. So we wanted to say the Noether theorem tells us that they're simple. These black holes are characterized just by their masses, their spins, which have some maximum value. And in the case of the final black hole, there will in general be a recoil that during this in spiral and during the merger, not only are energy and angular momentum emitted in gravitational radiation, but linear momentum is as well. And so we have a very simple initial state, a very simple final state. And so we wanted to say, if you almost thought of this as a scattering process, with the middle being very complicated, what could we learn purely from the symmetry of these very initial and final configurations? And so we wanted to think about it in as much a naive way possible, a spin expansion. So as I said, non-spinning black holes are more well understood than spinning ones. They've been simulated for longer. Now, if we consider two arbitrarily spinning black holes, and the spins are in general pointed in different directions, can we think about that by just Taylor expanding about the non-spinning case? So what we do here is we at first define an orthonormal triad. So we have our initial binary black hole system. We have two black holes. Our triad is formed. One element of the triad is just a unit vector pointing from black hole A to black hole B. A second unit vector is basically parallel to the orbital angular momentum of the system. And then the limit that they're widely separated, the orbital angular momentum of the system dominates any individual spin angular momentum and is perpendicular to the separation. And finally, the third orthonormal triad vector is just determined to give you a right-handed triad. And so we have these three basis vectors, E1, E2, E3. And then we have our final and initial quantities. We have initial masses, initial spins, which we define as A and B, and we make these dimensionless, A and B equals 1 being maximally Kerr-spinning black holes. We have the final spin S and the recoil velocity, the recoil kick during the merger. And so these final quantities, the mass, the kick, and the spin, and essentially any other final quantity, we can just Taylor expand in terms of the components of the initial spins of black hole A and black hole B projected onto these orthonormal triads. And so here we just use Cape Perp as an example of the component of the recoil kick perpendicular to the orbital angular momentum. So this is in the orbital plane. This is one of our final quantities. And we see we just very naively choose a Taylor expansion. A1, A2, A3, B1, B2, B3 are the components of the initial spin. And Q here is the mass ratio of the initial black holes. It's the mass of black hole A versus the mass of black hole B. And we're not Taylor expanding that. So we're leaving our coefficients as functions of Q. This is an infinite series summed over different powers of these initial spin components. And so initially, if you think about this, this is going to be horrendous. We're summing over here M1, M2, M3, N1, N2, N3. So at first order in the spins, you're going to have 6 terms. At second order, you're going to have, by symmetry, you're going to have 21 terms, and it will just grow exponentially. It seems like a disaster. But symmetry helps us a lot. We think about 3 different symmetries. First of all, rotation. All these components were defined to be inner products of our orthonormal triad and our initial and final spins and kicks. So all these things are invariant under that. We think about parity in the sense that going back to our triad, this is a pseudovector. These two are both vectors. These things are pseudovectors. The mass is obviously a scalar. And so just, you know, the product of 2 pseudovectors is a scalar. The product of a pseudovector and a vector is a pseudoscalar. And the product of 2 vectors is also a scalar. So all of our initial and final quantities transform in well-defined ways under parity. And they also transform in well-defined ways under exchange, operator X. That's just basically relabeling black hole A and black hole B. And clearly that can't change any of the physics of the system. And if we look at our the way we've defined this, switching A and B reverses the sign of E1. Since it reverses the sign of 1, it reverses the sign of E2. The orbital angular momentum won't change under the relabeling. And A and B switch. Q, since that's the mass ratio, goes to 1 over Q. All our initial and final properties transform in a well-defined way under exchange as well. And so the basic idea is that even though you've got a horrendous number of terms in this crude Taylor expansion, since all the final quantities will transform in well-defined ways under parity and exchange, they can only be constructed from terms, from combinations of our initial spin components that transform in the same ways under parity and exchange. And so how does this help us? At zeroth order, there's just going to be 1 term in general. At first order, you'd think there'd be 6 different terms, you know, 1 term proportional to each of these 6 variables. But in fact, for K-perp, which K-perp is the inner product of the kick, which is a vector, and the E1 and E2, which are our orthonormal triads in the orbital plane, these are vectors too. So this is a vector times a vector, so it's a scalar. And under exchange, the kick basically stays in the same direction. But we've relabeled A and B, which means we've reversed our E1 and our E2 orthonormal triad. So K-perp has to change sign under exchange. And so what we see is, in terms of the initial spin components, we can only, since this is a scalar, we can only have scalars. That means we're just left with the 3 components of the spins. And since it has to change sign under exchange, if I flip A and B, this thing has to change sign. And so we've gone down from just 6 terms just to 1. This is in the equal mass case. It's a little bit more, a little bit less clean in the unequal mass case, but again, you still have a tremendous reduction. And at second order, we go down from 21 terms in general just to 6. So basically, we're making a very, very naive assumption about doing a Taylor expansion, and we're using symmetry to just simplify the number of terms that we get. Why we're doing this is going to be, see, the proof is really in the pudding, that this is going to actually give us a lot of interesting insights in a second, you'll see. The main idea is, number one, it's simple. This parity and exchange and Taylor expansion are really the only ideas driving what we've talked about now. It's a way, you know, it's a way of giving information to the community without really having to dig into the guts of the numerical relativity. It complements a lot of existing approaches. So there's 2 basic approaches to studying this problem. Kind of a post-Newtonian approach, where we have equations that work well in the wide separation limit, and they're very, you know, well, it's challenging to compute, but it can be done. But these things break down in the final stages of the merger as the gravitational fields get strong and the speeds become highly relativistic. So you can't, our symmetries will hold through the entire in-spiral merger ring-down process, whereas the post-Newtonian expansion breaks down. And in addition, the numerical relativity, in addition to being, you know, it still has systematic errors associated with it, and it's very computationally expensive to do these simulations, whereas a Taylor expansion is super cheap to do. We separate basically the results that really, some of these surprising results actually can be explained in terms of these simple parity and exchange considerations. And so it separates what is really surprising about GER from things that we should have anticipated on these much simpler grounds. And also, it's just efficient. As we said before, if you think of the total parameter space of black hole mergers that you're going to want to consider, it's seven-dimensional. You've got two black holes. You've got their mass ratio to consider. And you've got all the different configurations, orientations of spins. By Taylor expanding in the spin components, we reduce essentially a seven-dimensional parameter space, which would be impossible to simulate, given how intensive these simulations are to do, to just a one-dimensional one. And so if you just spin it in mass ratios and calibrate our coefficients, with a small number of simulations, you'll get a lot further than just crudely going through the parameter space trying to map it out that way. And this is very much, I don't know how familiar you are with the existing state of the literature. People have considered fitting formulas of the kind that we're doing in the past. These things are called Kidder formulae because they were basically developed. Larry Kidder, first of all, is not here now, I guess. He's at Cornell. They're named after him. He derived post-Newtonian expressions for the instantaneous loss of energy, linear momentum, and angular momentum to gravitational radiation. And so basically what people did was they looked at the lowest order, the linear order terms in the spin in these instantaneous expressions and just replaced all the radial dependence and the Q dependence with just fitting formulae, just with coefficients that they hoped to calibrate numerically. Part of the problem of this approach is that people have only claimed that this can be applied at merger. And so people so far in their simulations have restricted their attention to special cases, like the align case, where your two black hole spins are lined up with your orbital angular momentum, because there's no precession there. You know, if they're all lined up initially, they stay lined up. And they've looked at other highly symmetric configurations, which allow them to apply these formulae. But in general, with arbitrary spins, there's going to be tremendous precession, and there's no way to translate, you know, your initial separation to final spins that you could plug into these formulae. And also that these things are all linear in the initial spins. Q is this mass ratio that I was talking about before. These things are just coefficients they hope to calibrate. And then this alpha 1 and alpha 2 are just basically the dimensionless Kerr spins perpendicular and parallel to the orbital angular momentum. But these expressions are just linear in alpha. There's no, our Taylor expansion includes, you know, arbitrarily high order dependence.
So if you imagine you start out, we said, you know, you start out in an initial state that is well described by just two isolated Kerr black holes. So by initial spins, I mean spins at this point. Then you imagine the system in spirals. And then there's some kind of final part right before where they merge to form a common horizon. These formulae are intended to be applied with the spins at that final point.
But isn't it well defined at that point?
Are the spins well defined? Well, numerically, yeah, you're right. I mean, the approximation breaks down. It's not clear. You know, in the wide separation limit, the description is two isolated Kerr black holes is good. People, there are different approaches trying to, you know, they look at the horizon and they try to identify, what the spin is. You're right, there are a lot of challenges with trying to do that. We see that as an advantage of our approach. So we've proposed this simple Taylor expansion for understanding the final state of black hole mergers. And we're going to see that it's an improvement in many ways over existing approaches. So let's look. This thing seems simple. I mean, the only way that we'll believe it is that it actually provides exciting results. So as I said before, one of the configurations that has gotten a lot of attention, these are all different papers that have looked at this, are the align configuration, where the three component is parallel to the orbital angular momentum. But here, in this case, the spins are parallel to the orbital angular momentum. And here we look at the final kicks in these configurations, the final spin, which is in the same direction as the orbital angular momentum, and the final mass. These different x's, squares, et cetera, all represent different simulations collected from these papers, and the various curves are fitting in just the first and second order curtailed expansions of the Lorentz spin expansion to these observations. We see that they fit very well, and we see that these things, the Kinder formulae that were shown before, are just straight lines, whereas we already see here, well, it's not quite easy to make out, but it's certainly true, that these are curves. There's definite detection of nonlinear effects, that the final spins and the final kicks are not linear in the initial spins. And this was already noted by Ratzel. Another configuration that has gotten a lot of attention is the super kick configuration. I don't know, it seems a little contrived. The idea is that you've got an orbital angular momentum, and then you have spins that are equal and opposite in the orbital plane. That's shown here. And this has gotten a lot of attention because if you extrapolate, they've done simulations at spin magnitudes of 0.6, 0.8, even 0.9. If you extrapolate up to maximally spinning curved black holes, you can get kicks as large as, in this case, well, this is not maximally spinning ones. This is, I think, 0.6 and 0.7 something. If you extrapolate all the way up to maximally spinning curved black holes, you can get almost 4,000 kilometers per second for your recoil velocities, which is enormous. It's a larger, you know, it's larger than the escape velocity of even the largest, elliptical galaxies. And so, if this is true, it has tremendous implications for trying to build up quasars at high redshift. If we really believe that there are black holes in the center of every galaxy, it's challenging in a lot of ways. How all that kinetic energy, even if it's not quite enough to get you out of the galaxy. How it then will chase its stars out of the center as an inevitable friction makes it settle down again. All these things are very challenging to understand. And we want to know, our approach is going to help determine just how finely tuned it really is. How close does the configuration have to be to get these large kicks? And so as I said, the super kicks have been noted before. But the remaining curves here, which are, and you can see there's a fundamental frequency here. This is just 0 to, this is in radians. So 0 to 2 pi is essentially here. This is the 0 to 2 pi, just the angle in the plane. People have noticed these spin kicks with the wavelength here is just unity. The frequency is, unity. People in the Campanelli group, they did these red curves here. But Campanelli is the blue curves. They noted the super kicks, and they provided these values for the radiated energy and the radiated angular momentum during these intervals. But apparently, in their paper, they didn't realize that a curve with twice the frequency here would fit these things extremely well. And this is what is predicted in our formalism. We understand why this thing has to have twice the frequency of this, because that's the only way that symmetry and parity will allow it to be. And Brueggemann, which did the red curves here, they did enough simulations that they could clearly identify
this frequency dependence. But in fact, despite the fact that they said our simulation showed this thing at very high confidence, they said that this is probably non-physical because they were looking for, again, they said, why isn't there one at the same fundamental frequency? Why is that not there? And, we should see that thing just as readily. And since we couldn't get consistent results for that one, how can we believe this one? But our formalism tells us that that thing shouldn't be there, and therefore it gives us a lot more confidence to believe this result. Another interesting thing is, we see these super kicks here. And people plotted these things up, fit the curves, it looked great. People felt really happy about themselves. The magnitudes of these kicks is linear in the initial spin magnitudes. But our formalism, our Taylor expansion, told us that you would get only odd multiples of the fundamental frequency. So in addition to these super kicks that we've seen, we also predicted that there would be third order corrections with 3 times the fundamental frequency. And so what we did was we just took these points that people had provided, subtracted off these curves, took the differences between the points and the curves, and saw that they were very well fit. The triangle points here very well trace this red line. And the square ones trace this blue line. And so there was a clear evidence for no second order term, but a third order term. And furthermore, the amplitude of this goes as the cubic power of the spin magnitudes. So if you fit the blue curve, and that kind of calibrates our coefficient, when you scale it up, this is linear in the spin magnitude, and this is cubic in the spin magnitude. And finally, to test this, we looked at fully generic configurations. This is just a bunch of simulations. You can't even really parameterize these by angles, because these 8 simulations provided here are just pointing it any which way. And so trying to apply a Kitter formula to this, when if they're pointing at it any which way, all kinds of precession would be there. You'd have no way of going from the initial orientations to the final ones. We showed that by calibrating our Taylor expansion with the many simulations available in this configuration, we were able to get these red points here without any fitting at all. And we see that they do a good job for both the final masses and the final spins. And where they break down is where we anticipate higher order terms will come into play. And so these blue curves are with the next higher order term, and we understand why the lowest order terms are not going to give you the spin that you need in this particular configuration. And so where do we go from here? We've already identified things and explained things that people hadn't seen or hadn't appreciated. But the existing simulations are less than ideal for kind of calibrating our Taylor expansion because they're too symmetric. You know, all our coefficients are kind of designed to fully map out arbitrary orientations. And so since most of the simulations available are either in the aligned configuration or the superkit configuration, we just can't calibrate our simulations. They've performed a lot of different orientations at the same spin magnitude, so it's harder for us to identify different terms should scale in different way with the spin magnitudes. And finally, people tend to only provide the magnitude of the kicks, which is very interesting astrophysically, but because the different components of the kicks transform in different ways under parity and exchange, we would be very interested in getting the components as well. And so we've proposed a new series of simulations. For the equal mass case, we only need 10 simulations. For the unequal mass case, we need 16 configurations. And once these simulations are done, it will uniquely specify all the coefficients in our expansion to second order. And then any additional simulations are predictive. And so we're working now with groups from Rochester and Penn State to try to convince them to get to work on doing some of these simulations, testing this. And so to conclude, we're really in a very exciting time for not just for the on the observational side with LIGO already online and LISA on the way, but on the numerical side, tremendously exciting breakthroughs have happened just in the past couple of years. These breakthroughs are great, but you'd like to say, you know, if we can make some analytical progress to understand what do we need the numerics for and what can we get at in a much simpler way, then that is very useful for us. Our approach is simple. It complements both post-Newtonian approaches and numerical approaches. It makes quantitative predictions that have already been verified and will make more when we have more simulations available. And it's very efficient. Ultimately, at the end of the day, if you're going to want to construct some kind of fitting function to plug into people's galaxy simulations, there's a lot of issues that go into this, but an important piece will be for generic arbitrary spin configurations, what kind of kicks do you expect? And our approach is streamlined to get that result with a minimum amount of numerical simulations. And so this is just an example of once we have components, once we have more simulations, we predict very well-defined predictions for the different, in those fundamental frequencies, which components of the kicks can depend in which way on the spin angles, and which components will scale. This goes as a linear, cubic, and fifth order in the spins. So it's very predictive, and we're looking forward to testing it further in the future. Thanks.
First of all, that's pretty cool. Second of all, just a comment that there's some, this is just pure, and I don't know if this is relevant, but there's a lot of work these days on experimental design, combinatorics experimental design, and And I don't know whether it's obvious that your 10 and 16 is the minimum possible number of simulations that have been done near coefficients. Can you prove that?
Well, that's the, there are, it's a second order, that's how many coefficients there are. It's, I mean, solving, I mean, that's, it's basically algebra. I mean, yeah.
Okay, so then it doesn't, then the thing.
And each simulation pins one of those numbers.
Yes, as you, I mean, I limited an amount of time, but I didn't get to really explain what these, there's more information here. So this is actually explicitly outlined, and we wanted to be as explicit as possible, the kinds of simulations you'd need, both for the equal mass and the unequal mass case. To different quantities, like we said, different components of the final kicks, different components of the final spin, the mass, transform in different ways under parity and exchange. Essentially, you have four different kinds of final quantities, plus or minus under parity, plus or minus under exchange. For everything except the scalars, that are, the ones that are both even under parity and even under exchange, you only need this restricted subset for the equal mass case, this restricted subset for the unequal mass case. And to get those other ones, you need these full sets. You start off with no spins, do simulations with only these components being non-zero. And as you do these things one by one, you begin to, each one of these nails down one of the coefficients of the second order. And this can then, well, we did it the second order because 16, each one of these things could be done in like 2 weeks or something. It depends on the size of your cluster, obviously. People already have done papers with, you know, sets of 20 simulations or something. So doing 10 is not really super.
The specific values of the parameters are not that important?
There's kind of a toss-up, you know. So in theory, we have the scalar expansion that goes to arbitrary orders. And obviously, these are components of the per spin, which, so they're less than unity. But there's a lot of terms. It's not super obvious that it will converge. We've seen that it does seem to converge very well. You'd want to do, if you do your simulations with too large a magnitude, then you're going to kind of get contamination from the higher order terms. We just cut it off at second order. But if you do it at too small a thing, then your second order terms are going to be tiny, and there's also still errors associated with these things. Finding a happy medium is going to be something that needs to be worked out. There's a lot of issues that need to be worked out. We've kind of specifically provided a set of configurations that we'll do it kind of in the simplest, kind of most straightforward way. In general, these are supposed to be generic, so most different configurations will do it, provided they're not too symmetric. If they're too symmetric, then there'll be degeneracies, and that's what this is saying, that if in some of these simulations the components are the same, then you'll have degeneracies, and so we have to make sure that doesn't happen.
So is it really true? So but I know in the setup, did you assume a circular orbit?
Yes, all of these, we've done some work, preliminary ideas, thinking about non-circular orbits. It's strongly believed that if you start off on an eccentric orbit, not just believed, but you can see this in both in post-Newtonian expansions and in simulations, that you'll radiate energy more efficiently than you will angular momentum. And so you'll settle down into a circular orbit. So astrophysically, that's what seems to be important. Virtually all the simulations out there are also geared at circular orbits. And so we were kind of constrained by that.
So LIGO sources are circular as before they enter the LIGO panel.
Yes.
Is there any hope of doing something, like this with waveforms?
We've thought about that. Obviously, the wave, unlike the initial and final states, the waveforms really do give you a lot, particularly for LIGO. We hope that there would be something we've done here. Much work remains to be done. We haven't really reached definitive conclusions.
We haven't tested it for strong. Same idea, hopefully, in the blocks, that you can treat the waves. That any general waveform you get out ultimately, since there's only seven initial parameters,
the same thing
can treat the exact same linear combination.
Yeah.
So if this is a chaotic process, then should it be hard or impossible to make this analytic formula?
If it's a chaotic process, it doesn't appear. If you look at these, if it was a chaotic process, it would be very difficult to do this. Ultimately, there are certain like phase angles that know, if you started arbitrarily wide separations, tiny changes in the initial separation will lead to, you know, large changes in just the total number of orbits. And so you'd expect, you know, you'd expect precession to be that once you've kind of done a bunch of simulations at a particular separation, we're hoping that you can use post-Newtonian formulae to relate things in the kind of in the weak field, you know, non-relativistic limit. I think you're right, though, ultimately, that if you did the initial separations at too large a separation, then yeah, I mean, for general configurations, the you know, it'd be challenging to match these things up into the regime that you can actually simulate. These simulations can only be started a few orbits before merger because they're very intensive to run.
So your result would be a function of that.
Right, absolutely, and we're working on this now. These sets of simulations are designed to be calibrated at a fixed value of the separation, and then we'll see how well we can use post-Newtonian relations to, you know, if we do 10 simulations at one separation, 10 simulations at another separation, just see how well we can understand relate the two. But it's not sampling the strong field theory.
So I'm not sure this would be relevant, but in general, you know, the best second order approximation to a function is not the first two terms of the Taylor expansion and truncate. Right, so for example, with something like this, if you did the simulations with the values of the spin parameters that are roughly what you would normally care about, and then let the higher order terms contaminate that as much as they do, and then just fit your expansion with those, you'll actually do better in that regime than if you got the correct first and second order terms. I mean, it may not be a huge difference, but back when computers were really slow and people evaluated, you know, standard functions with Taylor expansions, they didn't truncate the Taylor series. They got the optimal coefficients for that many orders and, you know, got
it's
a better
like
fit to the function.
So you're saying, so we're proposing to do a bunch of simulations, and then you use the final values you get in the initial components to calibrate the coefficients. You're saying if we don't truncate it, then in general, for just this limited 10, you know, there's going to be more than 10 terms, you know, beyond second order. So I'm not sure exactly what you're proposing.
Are you saying instead of expanding in monomials, you should expand in Chebyshev polynomials or something like this?
Well, if you do the right things to expand in, you would do that. But yeah, I mean, in general, just a Taylor series is not the right way to expand.
Do you need some kind of additional limit confirmation? I mean, to identify. I mean, if the Taylor, you're saying somehow there should be ways of defining relationships between the terms in the Taylor expansion.
Maybe we should talk about it.
Yeah.
Can I say one thing in response about sort of both these things? I mean, so yeah, I think the symmetry arguments, those are just kind of true. But the fact that the Taylor expansion, the first two orders in it worked so well. You know, so these typical simulations are quite large. They're nearly maximum spinning. They're 60% of maximum spinning or something like that. So the fact that a small spinning Taylor expansion worked so well. That part was very surprising. And so it's kind of, you might say it's a surprise of numerical relativity that everyone thought that black hole merger was going to be a very chaotic, sensitive function of the initial spins. Mm-hmm. And this, it turns out to just not, it's
right.
One of the surprises.
It's not Hamiltonian system, so it probably is not chaotic.
You kind of like to understand why it works, though, wouldn't you?
I would like to understand why it works. Yeah.
Which is a much deeper question than what I was saying. I was just making a comment. When you expand things, you know, they're usually better things than Taylor expansions.
All right.
Well,
I think let's
thank Mike and all of our speakers again for very great things. So I do have to announce that there's a very nice reception going on that we can't go to because it's not for us. There's a